This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Finance Advisory are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin back with you and the wake-up call for Friday, October the 16th. Now, this is actually a recorded show because on Friday, which is tomorrow, I will not be in the office at 10 p.m. I will be giving a seminar in downtown Singapore. So I have to record this show today, which means please no live calls, though of course you're always welcome to send in your emails at any time, and I will deal with them at the first available moment, which is appropriate. Now, I have to apologize for two people who called in on Monday, and they were waiting patiently to have their calls answered, and I was racing against time to finish the comment that I made about gold, and I didn't even quite finish that. I'm going to do that today, but it did mean that I was unable to take your calls, for which, again, I apologize. So, no live calls today, please. All right. I have been getting a lot of questions from people about this question of inflation and deflation, and when we're likely to see the end of deflation, the beginning of inflation. As I've always said, this bias in favor of inflation is really a life-saving measure that people are employing in order to be able to cope with the coming downturn, because they feel rightly that they have a far greater chance of coming out in one piece at the other end, as it were, if there is inflation as opposed to deflation. And of course, the bad news is that we are not only going into deflation, but we're already very firmly there. And even people at the highest levels of economic thought just simply refuse to believe it. It's denial through and through. It's the kind of Pollyanna approach run amok, even among those whose opinions I've come to respect. They're still harping on the inflation theme. The only explanation which I have for that is that they feel that it is the only way out, and that the only way of achieving inflation is to sort of talk it up, talk their book. It is sadly and tragically misguided. We are in deflation, most definitely. Everything that points to deflation is in place right now. We've discussed this ad infinitum. And the best, you know, that I can do at this point is to try to discuss when, if ever, we will move from deflation to inflation. You see, everybody looks at the Fed's bloated balance sheet. But the problem is that the reserves the central bank has created are sitting as cash in the banking sector balance sheets and not being recirculated into net new creation of credit, which of course suggests that the velocity of money is still contracting. And not only is the velocity contracting, but so are the broad monetary aggregates. Now, from a labor market standpoint, there cannot be inflation without accelerating wages, as I've pointed out so many times. And the economy is now operating at a level that is equivalent to 10 million jobs short of full employment. So basically what this means is that we are anywhere from 5 to 10 years away from seeing any sustained increase in inflation. And there was recently a study done, a Rutgers study in the Wall Street Journal, which suggested that we will not see 5% on the unemployment rate again until the end of the year 2017. And Global Insights has a 5.75% jobless rate occurring no sooner than 2019. Again, to get back to a cycle high, we need to create more than 10 million jobs. But before that happens, the deflationary pressures are going to trump whatever inflationary risks arise from the Fed, Congress, and the White House. The last time, by the way, that the ratio was this low was back in December 1983. And back then, the household debt per capita was $9,900. Today, ladies and gentlemen, it is 6 times larger at $58,000. At the margin, one has to wonder what is going to be paid back first. The debt service payments coming out of the paycheck are looking increasingly vulnerable. Default rates are extremely likely to worsen for the foreseeable future. Groceries will not be sacrificed. Credit, however, will. So basically, we are barely one quarter of the way through the deleveraging process needed to bring interest charges into alignment with income-generating capacity. Again, this is going to prove to be a highly deflationary process in terms of what it implies for U.S. consumer demand. Now, as I've been telling you for countless weeks on the wake-up call, banks have not been lending their huge reserves. They had been hoarding them. So what are the banks going to do with all their cash? Well, the latest data indicate that the Fed's reserve creation showed through as cash on bank balance sheets ballooning $182 billion in September. That's plus $64 billion just in the last week on the month to an all-time high of $1.076 trillion. The banks, instead of finding new credit-worthy borrowers in private sector to lend to, are basically lending the Fed's reserve creation right back to Uncle Sam. If you're wondering who is funding the deficit, it is the major banks. They bought $31 billion of government bonds last week of September, bringing monthly pickup to $52 billion, which is, by the way, the fourth highest on record. Well, recently I talked about the futility of economic reporting and what is euphemistically described as research. The typical Wall Street economist sifts through the data like a robot, tweaking numbers here and there and basically doing little more than reporting what the numbers are doing. But nowhere do we see adequate analysis over what is termed behavioral economics. The economists are so focused on the minutiae or the background noise that they can't see the forest past the trees. They can't see that attitudes towards credit, home ownership, and discretionary spending are undergoing a profound change. And as they focus myopically on the ISM index, they don't see that households now understand that they have to shrink their balance sheets and alter their budgets. Right. Richard Martin here with the Richard Martin Wake Up Call, and if you would like to email in your questions and comments for Monday, you may do so. Understanding, please, that again, this is a recorded show, recorded 24 hours back on Thursday, so please email your questions and comments, and I will deal with them on Monday when I am back live. The email address is rm@gfawd.com. Now, RM is Richard Martin. GFAWG is Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. That's gfawd.com. What's more, the email address, rm@gfawd.com. And as always, if you would like to call me with your personal matters, your personal questions, be they what they may, you are always welcome to call me. And the number is a Sarasota, Florida number, which calls through to Singapore, which is area code 941-441-1682. Once again, the number to call if you would like to call me on a personal basis, you may do so by calling 941-441-1682. Okay. Well, I read recently a damning report by the European Commission on the long-term prospects for Britain's public finances, which warns that Britain is at a, quote, high risk of running unsustainable debt. In fact, they claim that Britain will not be able to service the debt. The only way in which they will become unwound is therefore by default or high inflation. Well, the United Kingdom is at high risk with regard to long-term sustainability of public finances. That much is very well known. But then so is the United States. And of course, you're not just dealing with the federal government here, you're dealing with state governments, all of which are sort of running out of money, most of which are. California leading the way with great, let's say, I was going to say pride, but certainly with great fanfare. This is why I am so insistent that this problem is just simply not going to go away, no, whatever the federal government or the Federal Reserve may decide to do. The whole shenanigans is past the point of no return. And this means that sooner the authorities allow these things to play themselves out unhindered and unsupported by these ridiculous stimulus packages, the sooner one can hope to turn the corner. But it seems that this is not going to be allowed to happen. It seems that one stimulus package is going to turn into another, and the awful pain waiting is just going to be drawn out over that much longer a period of time. And for that, of course, we have the experience of the Great Depression, where this very same thing happened. A relatively small and insignificant downturn was turned into a Great Depression directly by the authorities and the government, and then made to straggle along agonizingly for another 8 or 10 years. None of which needed to have happened, but it looks like we're seeing the same thing this time round, and it looks like it's going to be a much more painful experience even than in the Great Depression. We're not even hearing about how bad it is from the powers that be. They're not even admitting that things are as bad as you and I know them to be, and we're along in good company with people who had indeed lost their jobs and their homes, or both. It's just a question of time before the powers that be come round to admitting this and then looking seriously at what the next step might be to alleviate the problem. Well, there's an interesting article that I came up against the other day on the 10 countries most at risk of a meltdown from the Business Insider and the Money Game. The 10 countries are, and I'll discuss them quickly, each one. The number one country that they talk about is Spain. And Spain is, of course, a basket case economy right now, as most people are aware. The finance minister recently declared that the worst of the crisis is over, but Moody's and other analysts believe that the country's banking system may be concealing massive loan losses. I think I've heard that one before, too. Well, Spain has 20% unemployment, not unlike, by the way, what the United States has if you look at the U6 unemployment figure, despite the 9.8% official rate, which of course is ridiculous by any standard. There has been a severe GDP contraction, and the 10-year housing bubble appears to have collapsed, all of which contradict the bank's apparent stability. London-based Varian believes that real estate losses alone could total $370 billion, which comes to about one quarter of Spain's economy. Well, Dubai is number two. They built this great theme park, and it cost the country or the state an enormous amount of money, most of which was borrowed. Property prices are down 50%. Huge amounts of money have been lost. And the city-state is required to receive financial support from rival Abu Dhabi. Standard & Poor's believes that the government has insufficient money to support its failing government companies and will require further support. Many property projects remain vacant and useless. $80 billion of debt, which of course is huge for Dubai, sits on the government's balance sheet. Iran is at risk. It's number three, both of a political and an international relations meltdown, especially if the government's anti-democratic or nuclear ambitions take a wrong turn. The rampant inflation of the past is under control, which is most recently near 10%, but there's a very high chance that it will resurface. Unemployment is at 11%. And that itself is fueling political tension. If oil prices do fall from these levels, that will be obviously disastrous for our country, since 85% of government revenue comes from the oil sector. Okay, the next country is Latvia, which I won't say much about, other than to say that the LAT could implode and take down both foreign lenders and local borrowers with it. The economy has collapsed. An expected 18% drop is slated for 2009. They had a long-standing currency peg, which is, of course, disastrous for a small country with few prospects. The peg will be broken, and the value of the lat could fall by 30%, which brings to mind Argentina. And that, of course, will cause great losses for the foreign banks, most notably the European banks, which are also looking at problems in the next country, which is Ireland, which has just suffered a spectacular collapse of its own property bubble, which threatened to turn the country into another Iceland, and they're certainly not out of the woods yet. The economy is expected to contract at over 7% this year, and fall further in 2010. The average Irish household faces negative equity situation similar to that of many Americans. So then we come to the next one, which is China. And of course, China is very proud of its bubble and economic progress right now. But it's charging into the future with such mass velocity that any sudden slowdown in the West could result in, a real wreck. Government stimulus is used to avoid an economic downturn, and it may be creating mountains of debt and vast expanses of excess manufacturing capacity. There is huge unemployment prospects if that should happen, and the real estate market, of course, is taking a tremendous blow as well, with vast tracts of uninhabited and unused real estate already in evidence. The next country we'll talk about is Venezuela, number seven. Frankly, if inflation were a barometer of economic success, Venezuela would be an economic titan. But the country's inflation rate will be the highest in the world, both this year at 28%, for many years to come, and that's according to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. The economy will contract this year, 2009, but it will almost certainly contract in 2010, despite expected growth of other economies in the region. Now, if the world stagnates, Venezuela will be done for. The country is highly dependent on oil prices, which of course would be slammed by any global economic double dip. Okay, next we have Lithuania, which resides right next to Latvia. The economy fell by a shocking 20% in the second quarter of this year, which was the worst decline for any European nation. Like Latvia, it has an economic currency peg, which is coming under extreme pressure, and deflationary forces have most certainly taken hold. If they are forced to abandon that peg, the resultant devaluation would mean huge losses for domestic borrowers with the foreign currency debt. Okay, so then number nine is Korea, talking about South Korea here. North Korea is its own basket case, but South Korea could be headed for a unique bust of its own. Despite a global real estate downturn, South Korean housing prices have been on fire. Seoul property prices jumped 20% this year, while consumer confidence in housing is at record levels. Low interest rates and floating rate mortgages could be fueling a speculative boom that could end badly once easy money and easy mortgages come to an end. That sounds eerily familiar, doesn't it? If the bubble pops, all come at a horrible time, since South Korea is just starting to rebound from the economic downturn. And country number 10, ladies and gentlemen, I am afraid you know which one I am about to refer to. It is not a million miles from where you are sitting right now. It is indeed the USA. I don't have to tell you about the risks still facing the American economy. Massive debts to the rest of the world, hugely exposed to an oil shock. Really still a lot of residual ill will from the recent Bush administration. I'm afraid to tell you that the United States is very close to a meltdown, and that meltdown is going to happen. And as I've told you on so many occasions, it behooves all of us to prepare and get positioned for the breakdown coming. You know, the problems in the banking sector are really only at the most halfway over. People don't talk about this. They don't mention the trouble in the banking sector. They tend to kind of give it a pass. But according to the IMF, the problems in the American banking sector are far from over. In their latest global financial stability report, they find that the economy is improving, which I disagree with, of course, but they say that the risks to the banking sector remain. They also conclude that any hiccup in the real economy would reverberate through the banking sector and further intensify the weakness in the broader economy. Credit channels are still impaired, and the economic recovery is likely to be slow, according to the IMF. Well, a key question addressed is whether the financial system can provide sufficient credit to sustain an economic recovery. Recently, bank balance sheets have benefited from capital-raising efforts and positive earnings. Nonetheless, there are still serious concerns that credit deterioration will continue to put pressure on banks' balance sheets. The analysis from the Global Financial Stability Report suggests that U.S. banks are more than halfway through the loss cycle to 2010, whereas in Europe, loss recognition is less advanced, reflecting differences in the economic cycle. The IMF estimates that banks have taken less than half of their total write-downs to date, while commercial banks have already written down $1.3 trillion. The IMF estimates that banks have another $1.5 trillion to write down. Of these write-downs, the U.S. is still slightly further along than their Asian and U.K. counterparts, which, by the way, is similar to what McKinsey recently reported. Much like Japan in the 90s, the banks have been given the green light to earn their way out of this crisis. With 1.5 trillion in write-downs coming down the pipe, it's unlikely that operating earnings will suffice in offsetting the losses. Banks are also facing a staggering $1.5 trillion in maturing debt over the next 3 years. And I quote from the IMF here, while stronger bank earnings are supporting capital levels, they are not expected to fully offset write-downs over the next 18 months. Moreover, steady-state earnings are likely to be lower in the post-crisis environment. Stronger action to address impaired assets will help bolster bank earnings capability and support lending. The tightening of bank regulation underway is expected to reduce net reserves and require more costly self-insurance through higher levels of capital and liquidity. End of quote. The McKinsey report came to the same conclusion. See, the challenge for many adequately capitalized banks is that they will find it difficult to generate enough income to cover loan loss provisions over the next 2 years. Moreover, it is unclear how long net interest margins will hold up. Since 2006, net interest margins have actually increased for the stress-tested banks, despite rising non-accruals, that is, when a loan defaults and a loan provision is made, it no longer accrues interest. For these banks, net interest margin has actually increased from 2.1% to 3%, which represents $70 billion of income annually. Much of this increase is due to rapid declines in funding costs thanks to the U.S. Federal Reserve, which has lowered the rates banks pay faster than the interest on their loan and securities books. As more loans go on non-accrual and as loans roll over, net interest margin may come under pressure, even if the Federal Reserve keeps rates low. This likely means banks are going to continue to be a drag on any potential recovery as they struggle with their own capital problems as opposed to servicing the debt needs of their customers. The IMF concludes that the economy is far from complete stability, and any decline in economic activity could cause a ripple effect in the banking sector, which could cause further deterioration in any recovery. And I quote, "The economic forecast for the remainder of 2009 and 2010 is still gloomy, and banks are not immune to a deterioration in the economic environment." End of quote. You see, while we're certainly seeing positive trends in the banking sector and the broader economy, it would be very foolish to conclude that the secular deleveraging problems have been resolved. Of course, the banking sector, being in bed with the government and the Fed, is unlikely to be allowed to wither. Instead, it's far more likely that the banks will continue to benefit as the taxpayer loses. That's to say, bailouts and taxpayer-subsidized programs aren't even close to being finished with. What does this mean for investors? One heck of a mess for future generations, for sure. You know, the banks have already marked back up most of their toxic assets. And by the way, anybody is welcome to qualify and quantify the derivative exposure of the banks. Can anyone quantify off-balance sheet issues? Trouble is, the devil you know is nothing to compare to the devil you don't. And to make a claim that we're halfway through this implies you know the issues fairly and squarely, but if you do know those answers, by the way, you're the only one on planet Earth. And that's what I do remind you of constantly, ladies and gentlemen, that it's not the situation today that can be projected forward. And it's the situation forward that needs to be projected even further forward. And the banks are very, very prone to the economic vicissitudes. And they are very, very severely negative right now. And as I'm very clear, there is no economic rebound. And things get worse. And all of the statistics that the IMF, McKinsey, and everybody else have cited in reference to where the banks stand go straight out of the window. Because at that point, the banks will have to deleverage even more. And as you know, the leverage effect takes you into areas and zones that nobody really even wants to go. But this could, and almost certainly will, result in gigantic losses to the banks that nobody has even begun to discuss. And, you know, it's always the same thing. It's nobody's interest to let them know these things. Nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news. It would be bad enough if they knew for sure that the bad news was actually coming their way, but they're always living under the specter that they could be wrong. And of course, if you bring bad news and you're wrong, then you're toast. And that's the problem we have. Nobody is prepared to speak up. Nobody will tell the truth. Nobody will produce the figures that need to be produced. And along with all that, I haven't even mentioned the off-balance sheet figures of the banks, which nobody knows what they are. And I defy anybody to say with any measure of accuracy how much money these banks have secreted away in off-balance sheets. We don't even know the amount of real estate they own that they will not declare because they don't want to flood the market with real estate. And even if we did know what that value was, what happens when the value of real estate falls? What happens to the value of the undeclared real estate? I mean, these are all snowballs that can radically alter the shape of things to come. And I would remind you once more, first started when the subprime loans came around, and everybody said when they imploded, this is just contained. And I used to make fun of the word contained, you know, and the expression was contained, yeah, contained to planet Earth. But of course it's not funny, and they have infected every other area of the economy. As these other areas get affected, then of course they start to affect further areas even more deeply. So nobody can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, where this thing is going to end. Nobody can tell you where the economy is going to go on the downside. I will simply make the observation, as I have done, that the depression that we are about to see supersedes in orders of magnitude anything that has ever been seen before in this country, including the Great Depression. All right, well, let's look at something a little bit more lighthearted to alleviate the pain. Cat Banyan of the Fawcett Society told the Treasury Select Committee that city bankers' clients are often invited to meetings in lap dancing bars. And by the way, when I talk about city, I mean the City of London, the business district. Murdo MacLeod city bankers entertain clients and try to generate business by offering trips to brothels. MPs heard today. Cat Badgett of Gender Equality Pressure Group, the Fawcett Society, told a Treasury Select Committee hearing into women's role in the City of London that there was a growing trend in the city to use prostitution to entertain clients. Quote, we took extensive evidence from individual women who said it was becoming frequent for meetings to be held in lap dance clubs, and I also had women speak to me and say that prostitution was being used in client deals or in ways to generate business, and that all of this culture created a very hostile environment, as you would expect, for female employees of those firms. End of quote. One former city worker who gave evidence to the Fawcett Society said that while working for a top international investment bank in the city, she witnessed a senior manager looking for a brothel to entertain some Russian clients. Quote, I was out drinking with some guys in my team when a very senior guy came over. He asked if anyone knew of a good brothel in Edinburgh. He said he had some Russian clients coming over and he wanted them to sign a multi-million pound deal. End of quote. She added that when she worked in the Tokyo office of the same company, her London-based colleagues would often bring British colleagues over to Japan for sex trips, where they would tell the company they were introducing clients to Japanese firms, but were actually visiting a number of seedy sex clubs. Quote, it's a deeply troubling problem that needs to be discussed openly. If we're going to get more women into those institutions, we need to change the culture before that happens. Well, on a more serious level, the committee launched an investigation into women's roles in the city as part of its attempt to prevent another crisis. And there will be two more hearings during which more evidence will be taken from people such as Harriet Harman, the Minister for Women and Equality, and Trevor Phillips, the Head of Equality and Human Rights. but the Select Committee inquiry itself raised a few eyebrows on its launch in July, as it emerged that only one of its 14 members would be a woman. Former Bank of England policymaker Charles Goodhart, who is now Professor Emeritus of Banking and Finance at the London School of Economics, told the committee that the worst financial crisis since the Second World War could have been prevented if more women had been on the boards of major companies. And I quote, "Women tend to be more cautious and have a longer-term outlook. I think that men can be more aggressive and prepared to take larger risks. There would have been less likelihood of the financial crisis if we'd had a larger number of female executives in the financial sector," end of quote. He also said that there were remarkably few female chief executives in the financial sector, and that it is a great pity, and I quote again, "I think that the longer-term and cautious tendency that women have as less of the alpha male would be beneficial," end of quote. Nicola Pease, who runs the fund manager J.O. Hambro, told the committee that equality legislation in Britain was preventing women from getting the top jobs in the city. She said that many firms were scared of hiring women because penalties for successful sex discrimination claims were unlimited. Another factor that put companies off employing women was that women in the UK could take up to 52 weeks of maternity leave compared with just 12 weeks in the US. A year's maternity leave is too long, and sex discrimination claims that run into tens of millions of pounds are ridiculous, she told the committee. That is a problem. I do happen to know that. I have a friend of mine who was the object of a sex discrimination suit brought against him. I know him well. I have absolutely no doubt that he was innocent. The alleged incident took place in a parking garage at the end of a working day. At the end of a working day, I may say, still well within working hours. And the woman was known for causing trouble in the company, she lost her suit, but this took 6 months of an extremely costly and emotionally draining lawsuit that culminated in arbitration and saved the company from a much worse fate. But it is a real issue, and there is no easy solution, at least I haven't heard of any. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to conclude my talk on gold that I had to curtail abruptly at the end of the last show on Monday. You will remember that we had mentioned the question of what money really is and how, in fact, gold is not money. Even when you see gold coins lying around, they're really not money for the simple reason that they're not quoted in terms of themselves. If the price of a good or a service was measured in ounces of gold, then gold would indeed be money. If gold could be valued in weight, then indeed gold would be a perfectly good form of money. But as long as gold is quoted in terms of another form of money known as the dollar or other currency, then you really cannot say that gold is money. Gold is the purveyor of bartering at that point, but the money element still remains the fiat currency that we've all got to know, to come to know and love. So gold is not really a store of value, as the gold is money crowd want you to believe. There really isn't such a thing as a store of value. It is kind of hard to come to terms with that concept. But value is always changing, and it is always whatever the next man says it is. And so you need to be very, very cautious about people who talk about gold in terms of, you know, $3,000 an ounce, or I've even seen $50,000 an ounce. This is just emotive speak designed to bring attention to the speaker or the writer. And quite frankly, nobody has a clue where gold is going to trade tomorrow at 10 past 2 p.m., let alone where it's going to be trading in, say, 15 or 20 years. So always be very aware that the movement in commodities and stocks is so often used as a prop by people who are trying to make money out of it, people who are writing books, like Harry Dent, who used to say when the stock market first hit above 10,000, that clearly the Dow Jones was going to 30,000. Well, of course, he changed his tune, and that didn't happen. And now he's talking about a depression, trying to make money out of that. But I think he sold a lot of his books. Dow 30,000, I remember coming out at, in the beginning of the century, 2000. I think he probably sold a lot of books at that point before the market melted down. So be very careful about believing people replete with their figures and their specific dates on which these things are supposed to happen. They really don't know, and 9 times out of 10, they have an agenda for why they're trying to get you to believe these things. So I thought I'd read you, actually, a segment from a book called From Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis, by Thomas H. Greco, because it explains very succinctly what I've tried to say, but in a more measured way, what this is all about in terms of value. And I quote, "The imposition of levies upon either debit or credit balances or both as a way of promoting their use as an exchange medium is counterproductive to the main objective of reciprocity, i.e. equal value for equal value. Since everyone benefits from the facilitating power of the system, buyers and sellers should bear an equal burden in the cost of its operation, and this burden should be kept to a minimum. In order to prevent the use of exchange credit balances for value storage, or the use of debit exchange balances for long-term financing, both could be time-limited. I would handle the matter by limiting both the amount of debits and credits which could be carried over from one period to the next. I would propose to periodically clear exchange balances to a capital account. Anyone who has purchased more than he has sold during the current period, or who wants long-term financing for any purpose, must find someone who is willing to assign his credits for a specified period. This is a capital market function. Likewise, anyone who desires to save his or her credits must find some suitable investment medium for accomplishing the storage of his or her value. In other words, side by side with the exchange system, there should exist a capital market in which savers and entrepreneurs can be brought together, in which surplus balances held by some can be allocated to others, savings or storage of value, to be used in capital formation investment or to finance consumer durables. Those traders holding credit balances, which means they have delivered more value than they have received, have a general claim against wealth owned by those holding debit balances. Similarly, those with debit balances have a commitment to deliver that much value to the community. Rather than allow these claims or commitments to be held indefinitely, they should be cleared, in other words, reduced to zero, at frequent intervals. This would tend to make these balances a pure exchange medium and extenuate the store of value function. The fact that the exchange medium is readily available to all producers and may be created as needed in the course of trade will tend to make it valueless in and of itself. Also, its value will diminish further the more frequently the balances are cleared. The next question to be answered is, what is the nature of this capital account? If the trading balances represent claims within a current account and they are strictly for the purpose of facilitating exchange, then the resultant increases or decreases must be translated into changes in ownership of real wealth. Thus, each trader to having a current account would also have a capital account representing his or her ownership share in some real assets or long-term claim against future production. These assets might be in the form of real property or capital equipment, while the claims might take the form of equity shares, e.g., common or preferred stock in productive enterprises. These instruments would constitute the store of value. Capital formation is the creation of new businesses or the expansion of existing ones. It includes construction of buildings, improvement of land to be recovered over a long period of time. In each case, whether current account or capital account, a credit balance represents a claim, and the activity which gives rise to the claim should determine whether it is currency or capital. In the former case, it is a short-term claim upon the market which is intended only to facilitate trade. It is a demand deposit which the market should be able to satisfy at any time. In the latter case, it is a long-term claim against assets which are not liquid, e.g., if the claim has resulted from activity which has produced tools, it will take time for the cost of the tools to be recovered in the production of consumable goods and their sale in the market. And that's the end of the quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to this in the archives, I'm going to suggest that you go back to the beginning of this quote. Just scroll back to the beginning of it and listen to it again. It is extremely important. And the reason that it's important is it because it was totally denied as a realistic definition in terms of value and the means of trade when the government cancelled out the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated the banks, which dealt in money as a facilitator of trade and also interest paid on that money, with investment efforts, which meant that money was then used basically, not to put too fine a word to it, to speculate. Now, since the 1930s, those two functions had been separated by law. In other words, no bank could engage in speculation, and no investment bank, a speculative engine, as it were, could take deposits and basically act as a clearing bank. And because all this had taken place in the 1920s and been very much an important contributor to the Great Depression, it had been felt that much could be achieved if those two functions were separated. And lo and behold, in 1998, President Clinton, who signed the legislation into place, those two separated functions were again joined at the hip, just as they had been before the Great Depression. And this, and by the way, this with the connivance and active encouragement of Alan Greenspan, who was the ultimate cheerleader in favor of bringing banks and investment banks together again. And you can see from what I read you, and you can see from the whole tenor of how the capitalist theory works in practice, that the two are simply are unworkable together. In other words, it is vital that investment houses stay away from banking, and more importantly, that banking stay away from investment houses. So that if you, the client, have money, you know that your money, when put with a bank, is safe, simply because that bank does not undertake speculative endeavors with it. That, of course, is no longer the case. I mean, you have no idea when you have money in a bank whether you'll ever see it again, quite frankly. And with the number of banks that have gone under just since the beginning of this year, which is almost 100 by now, you can be forgiven for thinking that banks are in serious trouble and that your hard-earned cash, which should be sitting in a bank, may not be there for you, notwithstanding the $250,000 insurance coverage by the FDIC. So there you are. That's basically, in a nutshell, what Glass-Steagall was all about and why it was, in fact, such a good idea. again, this whole idea, the concept of whether there were or weren't enough regulations to deal with the problems that we have. Of course, we're being told today that there weren't enough regulations, that we need more regulations. Well, there were plenty of regulations. The powers that be simply ignored them and turned their back on them, and everybody got a free pass. And so, of course, the regulations were simply not applied. But they don't want to admit that. They want to tell you that there weren't enough regulations, so they want to make more regulations. And further regulations will stifle the economy even more, and totally unnecessarily. But that's the way that human beings lead their lives. Their pride is greater than their ability to see the wood for the trees. So we all have to live with this, and it's very sad, but such is life. All right, I'm going to finish with a brief description of what is called the carry trade. Now, the carry trade, many of you will have heard about this, I think. The carry trade is basically a device where people, investors or speculators, look at a currency and see that it is so cheap to borrow in that currency that they can borrow money from that currency, exchange it for another currency, and invest maybe even in risk-free accounts with banks, with central banks, and make risk-free money from so doing. Now, of course, the danger there is that the currency that you have transferred out of will suddenly increase in value vis-a-vis the currency you transferred into to gain the higher rates of interest, and then you'll lose money on the currency transaction. This, as I say, it's called carry, and it's alive and well and seems to be getting stronger as time goes by. As I say, it's borrowing proceeds in a low-yielding currency and reinvesting those proceeds in higher yielding or higher capital gains opportunities. And the desire for those opportunities has been coined by the phrase risk appetite. And we find plenty of good risk appetite opportunities in the various different stock markets, which have made tremendous gains in recent weeks, as you know. But because the biggest capital gains opportunities are perceived to be offshore, outside the U.S., in faster growth and higher interest rate currencies, risk appetite investing is part and parcel to move money out of the U.S. dollar. So let me just give you an example of this. It's quite important to know a little bit about this right now because of what's happening. Let's compare the United States to South Korea on yield and growth. 2-year government notes in South Korea are yielding around 3.4% more than 2-year government notes in the U.S. Well, that is, of course, a huge difference, a yield difference. Imagine what you could do with another $3,400 a year on every $100,000 invested. And if the South Korean currency were to increase in value against the U.S. dollar at the same time as it's now doing, you get a double kicker. So after knowing this big yield differential, you also notice South Korea is growing faster than the U.S. and emerging quickly from the credit crunch days. You can see why investors seeking total return would risk moving money into South Korea out of the U.S. Now, growth, or the expectation of above-average sustained growth, is often a powerful driver of long-term capital investment or foreign direct investment. This represents long-term capital flow, expected to stay in a country for many years, wanting to be positioned capital gains opportunities that are expected to follow. So at the moment, South Korea is winning against the U.S. in terms of relative yield and capital gains opportunities in a big way. And this is a pattern that we're seeing in many countries around the globe when comparing them to the U.S., especially among the emerging market countries. From a pure qualitative perspective, an input we can't measure by numbers but just feel, there seems to be a growing palpable difference between what we're seeing the emerging world and the U.S. Offering. The emerging markets are anxious to grow. They're putting in place policies to attract capital. They are fiscally much better off and a lot more disciplined than the US. Most emerging market countries want to do business and understand the great advantages of capitalism, while the US seems to be spending more time bickering about healthcare and climate change and how to expand government programs, or put another way, how to destroy the goose that laid the golden egg, instead of reinvigorating its entrepreneurial class. So, as long as the US stays mired in its current funk, which is a self-induced funk indeed, the carry trade will live and capital gains will continue to be offshore. Now, this will end suddenly and abruptly if and when the dollar rallies and the trades will panic out of their current carry, the currencies back into the dollar. And this, of course, in turn, will push the dollar higher. And this is actually one of the things that I feel that we need to be aware of, that at some point, the US dollar, which has fallen very dramatically over the last few months, will make a concerted and very specific upward move, and will, of course, along with that, take the other currencies down and cause people to panic out of their carry trade investment. Okay, well, just got a few minutes left here. I thought something for the ladies might be in order here. The new nationwide survey released a couple of days ago by Citigroup revealed that women across all economic sectors believe that their personal financial situations have deteriorated over the past year, and that the majority, 65%, have permanently changed their spending and saving habits in response to the recession. According to the data, key findings include 38% of women say they are worse off financially compared to 1 year ago, including women with household incomes of at least 100,000, 29%, and women with at least 250,000 in assets excluding real estate and retirement, 39%. The large majority of women across all annual family income levels rate the economy as only fair to poor, including 79% of women with less than $50,000 in income, 70% of women with a family income of more than $100,000, and 73% of women with more than $250,000 in assets. 3 in 5, 63%, of women believe that the country's economic conditions will deteriorate further before things hit bottom, a similar assessment as men at 61%. Lisa Caputo, chairman and CEO of Citi's Women & Co., a financial resource from Citi dedicated to helping women achieve their financial goals, had this to say. We know that women are a critical barometer for the U.S. economy because they drive the majority of household spending decisions and increasingly manage how their families invest. This new data reveals this is a transformational recession for women who are particularly feeling the effects of the economic downturn and tightening their purse strings and protecting their lares. According to the survey, working mothers have been hardest hit by current economic conditions, with more than half, 53%, indicating that they are working longer hours to make ends meet, compared with just 24% of women without children and 33% of men who said the same. Polling data also revealed that 75% of all women and children say their spending and savings habits have forever changed, compared with 61% of women without children and 60% of all men who said the same. Specifically, 63% have postponed the purchase of a major item such as an automobile or other expense item, compared with 50% of women without children in the home and 52% of men. 52% have taken money out of savings or investments to help pay expenses, compared with 42% of women without children and 39% of men. At the same time, women with children are most likely to have returned to school in an effort to increase their employment opportunities, with nearly a third, 31%, pursuing additional education, compared with 16% of women without children and 21% of men. Wealthier women are also making changes in response to the recession, with fully two-thirds, 66%, of women with assets greater than $250,000 and 71% of women making more than $100,000 reporting that they are cutting back on everyday expenses. Nearly half, 46%, of both groups say they are postponing purchases of major items, and 29% of high-income and 31% of high-asset women say they have thought about postponing their retirement. Although just one in five, which is 21% of women, believe that we have reached the end of the recession, women across all categories expressed optimism that circumstances will improve over the next 12 months. Nearly three in five women, that's 58%, expect that business conditions in their area will become much or somewhat better over the next year, a sentiment shared by 57% of the men surveyed. Well, I'm glad to have brought that information to you because women so often get left out of these discussions. With the trend being towards a larger and larger number of singles in our community, it is very important to see how women are being advantaged or disadvantaged in terms of the workforce and the employment opportunities. I think that in future years, you're going to see a much greater proportion of women in the marketplace. You certainly see that here in Singapore, where I am, which, by the way, is also offering very interesting opportunities to people from all walks of life and from all different societies and ethnic origins to come and live here and to partake of the wealth of this country, which I think is going to grow exponentially over the next 50 years. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I will be back live with you on Monday, so it remains for me to wish you a wonderful weekend. Have it, and I shall talk to you soon. This is Richard Martin for the Wake Up Call saying bye-bye till then.